Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will King Kong make an appearance? In this episode, actor Danny Sapani will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Sapani has appeared in Penny Dreadful, Black Earth Rising, Killing Eve, Harlots, Black Panther, Halo. He stars in the new UK TV thriller The Diplomat, and he can tell the difference between white wine and red wine through sight alone. Danny Sapani, welcome to Greenlit.
Thank you, Toby. Very great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming aboard. First question, though, Danny, is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
I would go with biopic. I don't know. Biopic just sounds a little bit, it's a biography. You wouldn't say biography. It feels like you're slightly overdoing it. So yeah, I would go with biopic.
Important that we get that nailed early on. And this, Danny, you've worked in a range, an array of mediums, TV, film, theatre. You've been starring in Halo recently, a huge show for Paramount Plus, massive stream. You've been in Star Wars, you've been Black Panther, Marvel. So you're kind of used, you might be used to these kind of meetings with executives. Are you used to these kind of meetings with executives if you're going to discuss your biopic?
No, I've never had to do that because I think as an actor, you tend to meet them on set and it's very sort of, hello, yes, 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 thank you for being involved. And you know, you hear them whispering with the director behind the camera, giving sort of notes and sharing their ideas. It's a very collaborative experience. But yeah, that tends to be my only connection, and then of course the premiere.
What's it like on set on those days when the I think the phrase sometimes used is the suits come on? Is there a change in tone? Like, are you aware of the day they're going to be there?
It depends on how high up you're looking. I mean, you always have the producer. There's always a producer on set on these jobs nowadays who's kind of very much involved in the whole creative process. And then when the suits turn up, I think luckily on most of the things that I've worked on, most people have got nothing to hide. So nobody feels that they're going to, it's not like having sort of Ofsted visit your school, you know, where suddenly you have to sort of be on your best behavior. Everybody just sort of gets on with it, really. And, there are no nasty emails that follow or haven't happened yet anyway.
You sometimes hear of actors and creatives, like directors, sort of talk about executives coming onto set and giving notes.
Yeah.
And they talk about it in a way in which that is, you're inferring, or maybe they're even explicitly saying there's meddling going on. Like all of a sudden you're being told, don't do it this way, do it that way, even though it's completely contrary to what you feel it should be or you know it should be. Have you ever had that experience? Is that something?
Yeah, but I've never had any executive come directly to me and say any of that. You know, it's usually the people who I'm already quite familiar with, either the director or the showrunner, and they don't tell you where that information is coming from. You can sometimes guess by the nature of the note that it might not be something that they've just thought up and it's come from, you know, higher up, as it were. But I think because of the editing process, there's plenty of opportunity to you know, change things and reshape things, you know, from an executive level. So they don't really need to worry too much about what happens on set. They leave that to the creatives.
And so you're going to have this meeting, Danny, with the executives, these suits you don't, so far, haven't had much to do with.
Yeah.
Where would you have that meeting, Danny? Where would you have it? At the studio? Would you have it in a fancy restaurant? Where would you want to have that meeting?
I think it would have to be, most likely it will be in some really big office, I imagine, with, you know, glass windows, you know, some fantastic city skyline all around us, semicircle table, which is very conducive. Some sort of long table. It doesn't have to be semicircular, but some sort of long table. Very light, you know, an opportunity to have a little sort of, you know, whiteboard behind us, you know, or a screen so that you could show a few clips of something, you know, and give them a sort of a little flavour of what to expect. A whole kind of presentation room, but really great open space with plush carpet, very comfortable, slightly scary.
Yes.
A little bit sort of just super impressive, you know, a super impressive space. That's what I imagine. It's unlikely it will probably be, it would probably be the back of, you know, someone's garage or something. Really, you know, cold and dark.
Danny, it's your biopic. You can have it wherever, okay, you like. But I love the idea of you already having like a mood reel, like a taster reel, a sizzle, yeah, of like what's going to be in there to show them. And also the, yeah, carpet, very plush carpet is an interesting detail. Is it one of those ones where like you can't see your shoes anymore? That's sunk so deep.
Not quite as thick a pile as now. Speak in technical terms. So maybe I don't know what's, you're probably thinking like, you know, something close to being in a field or something. I'm thinking more of a nicely cut lawn, but just, you could take your shoes off if you, yep, wanted to.
Yeah.
And maybe a few of them do, and you know, they take their jackets off and everybody, ooh, feels like they're at home. You know, there's fruit and water and, yes, on the table.
That's Marvel money. That sounds like Marvel money to
it
me.
It does, Danny, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. It's certainly not a UK TV. I jest, of course. But yeah, no, it's a big budget movie.
Well, we're gonna get onto this, Danny, and you're right to say it's big budget, you're right to give it that ambition. So exciting news, your, yeah, life has been greenlit for a biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So it's a big first question, Danny. What's the, yeah, film called? What's the biopic of Danny Sapani's life called?
It's called No Way Out, No Surrender.
No Way Out, No Surrender?
And I think it's a heist movie.
Do tell.
Yeah, there's a twist. There are moments of quiet. But there's a lot of action in it. There's lots of, you know, fast cars, helicopters. You know, this is all completely imagined because my life is quite the opposite. But I just think, it, you know, if you're going to tell a story,
yeah,
on a big screen,
yeah,
give it some welly.
Right. So that's it. Feels No Way Out, No Surrender is kind of like a conflation of two film titles. I think both from the 80s. There's No Way Out with Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman. Was it a political thriller, isn't it, that one? And there's, yes, was it No Retreat, No Surrender? Was that like
No Retreat, No Surrender?
Do you remember that? Was that like a beat 'em up kind of film, kind of a kung fu?
Could be. Yeah.
So No Way Out, No Surrender.
No Way Out, No Surrender. I don't know why I've come up with that, but there's a yeah, the theme is, you know, has a lot of jeopardy in it.
I like the idea. It conveys a sense of your back's against the wall, but yeah, there's absolutely no way you're
backing down.
Backing down. Is that an attitude you've had throughout your life? Would you say, is that something that you've always had?
I grew up in Hackney, Toby. You know, Hackney in the 70s and 80s. You know, there were definitely moments of genuine jeopardy. I mean, I think there's a sort of slight myth that growing up in London, in the poorest borough in London at the time, was horrendous. But you know, we rode our bikes. We stayed out late. I've never been attacked, but you know, you hear about things. It's more to do with the, you know, what. This is a very class-based society, isn't it? And you have to be ready to push forward and stand up for yourself to get anything done, to get anything out of it. So I think probably there is a bit of you know, Dunkirk spirit in growing up in London in these times.
When you look back on it now, I imagine it was a tough. You've already intimated it was a tough place to grow up, but particularly as a young black man, I guess, in the 70s. Do you look back on it now, kind of like a sense of amazement about the kind of the things that you saw and faced at that time?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, you don't really think about it, because what you grow up with and what seems, you know, what was every day is just normal to you, really. But when you sort of talk to other people about it, it is quite shocking, you know. You would often see, you know, skinheads walking the streets when I was at primary school, you know, glue sniffing and you know, the front line with people sort of selling, you know, all manner of drugs and what have you. There was a little economy going on over there. People being stopped by the police, you know, for nothing sometimes, mm-hmm. and for whatever. And just an air of danger, you know, an air of a sense that, you know, that at any point something could kick off. But, you know, at the same time, community, at the same time, people sort of, you know, you knew your neighbours, you know. Where do I live now? I live in North London. And you know, there are certain areas where people just don't know who their neighbours are. They don't, you know, nobody talks to each other, you know. That sense of community, I think, is really important, particularly if you're growing up in a tough place where, you know, there's a real mix of rich and poor, of lifestyles. Diversity is something I grew up with, you know. I think it wasn't until I sort of entered the professional world that it became so kind of directed in terms of, you know, where people, you know, class-wise or, you know, race, where people sort of were expected to be or how they were expected to behave or how they were looked upon. You know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, we had every nation under the sun and every class division, you know, that was available in this country, all mixing together, because that's just the way that people got on in places like Hackney.
When did you move out of Hackney? How old were you?
Well, I left home when I was 15, actually. Wow. And then went on a bit of a journey around different parts of London as an estranged child. I think it was more because I just wanted my own flat. I came from a big family and I just sort of thought to myself, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not to say that it wasn't tough, you know, being a bit homeless for a while, but there was incredible support for that sort of thing, you know, if you knew where to find it and you weren't sort of, you know, you didn't have other issues to navigate, which a lot of the kids that I came into contact with did have other issues, which made it very difficult for them to sort of just be able to get on. But, you know, I had a few nights out on the street, but, you know, I could always call home.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a journey.
Yeah.
Even that seems pretty normal to me. And I think to most people, I mean, I would be devastated if my kids left home at 15, and my parents were, but I think they also knew that I was, you know, probably more capable, more capable than maybe I give my own kids credit for.
What did you ever regret that decision at any stage? Like, you say you had a couple of nights where you were homeless. Like, did you ever think, nah, I'm not so sure this is a great idea?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was it was pretty hair raising at times, but I think it was character building, if I'm honest, and it meant that I had a sense of independence. And also, you know, like I say, the services that were there and available, should you be able to find them, were incredible. You know, Alone in London and Circle 33, the housing association, and also, you know, government support, which I don't know is as available as it is now. But if I didn't have those things, I wouldn't have made it.
Did you meet anyone particularly interesting when during that period? I just wonder. Did you meet any like-minded teenagers who were doing the same kind of thing? You know, musicians or artists or anyone?
Not really. I guess there were some people. There was a couple of fashion designers, people that, you know, who I haven't really kept in touch with. I don't know. I haven't seen them since. My saving grace was that I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I was doing my A-levels at the time. You know, so 16, 17, And I knew I wanted to be an actor, so everything was sort of aligned. I had a focus, meant that I didn't sort of stray too far off the kind of straight and narrow path.
I've got to be honest with you, Danny. There's so much pressure to do well at A levels, when you're that age. Combining that with kind of being self-sufficient at the same time, that is a lot, man. That is a lot.
I mean, it's sort of, it's kind of the point in a way, I suppose, to develop some level of independence so that, when you go to, drama school or further education at uni, you're prepared to sort of hit the ground running. As they say, youth is wasted on the young. And I think I had to grow up pretty quickly because of what I'd seen and where and the life that I'd lived. So I felt like I was ready to sort of, to get into it, and luckily it all turned out well.
I'm not saying you went method at a very young age, Danny, but it does sound like you went method at a very young
age. Yeah, I think I was maybe, at times, like you say, I did sort of regret, and as I say, I would not wish this for my kids. Yeah, I wish for them to have the confidence that it builds, but not necessarily the pain that you have to go through at times to get there.
When did you, and like, it's I don't know, maybe I'm being wrong here, but like to have that focus sort of at such a young age, to me feels quite unusual. Right? Yeah. Like there are some people who do, but I don't think necessarily many people have that kind of intensity of focus. So why did you know at such a young age that you wanted to be an actor? Like what had you seen, what or heard that kind of had made you think, I have to do this. This is something I have to do.
Yeah. I had an amazing teacher. I had amazing teachers along the way. With each, from about the age of 7, we had an amazing drama teacher. She was incredibly creative. She would adapt books and stories and find a way to, write songs. And we had a pianist at our school who was also the secretary. And it was just the 70s, man. This is what people did. They just kind of, they just put their, they didn't need, whatever the establishment were offering. They just sort of mucked together. It was the times of the GLC and just there was a sense of people kind of doing it themselves. And she was very much that sort of drama teacher. And she, she chose me to be in the play from a young age. Kind of, they must have seen something that I hadn't seen. I think I was probably, quite a sort of troubled or quiet kid. And once I got an opportunity to sort of don a costume and be in a character and tell a story, it just lit something inside me. And then later on, each, secondary school, the weekend arts college, which was what I started going to from the age of 14 till I was 19, which was a weekend performing arts school run by Celia Greenwood. Just all of these different sort of examples of a community and an access to the imagination. I couldn't see myself doing anything else. I was very lucky. It just instantly lit a spark in me, and I just carried on from there.
What was the name? What was the lady's name? Do you remember the teacher's name when you were quite
Miss Hyams?
Yeah,
Miss Hyams. If only I could. She left when I was in year 6. Yeah, so before I went to secondary school, and before she left the year before, actually. So I must have been in year 5, and I remember her turning round to me when I was about sort of, 10 or something like that. And I'd known her since I was sort of 7. I'd been involved in all of the school plays. And she came up to me and she said, "Don't stop, don't give up. You're really good." And I literally just burst into tears. And I'll never forget just sobbing that she was leaving, because she was moving to Wales.
How could she? How could she?
How could she? How could she desert me? And then, you know, there were years of pain after that, of, you know, because all of the sense of self-doubt, you know, is this going to work out? This is what I want, but is it really, you know, is it, you know, lots of people saying to you, well, it's a very, very, it's very, very difficult being an actor, you know, and for those that don't make it, you know, and this constant sense that, you know, it just made the dream and the hunger even stronger in many ways. So, yeah, that's, I owe it all to Miss Hyams.
I wonder then, the title sounds amazing, right? No Way Out, No Surrender, because I think we've ascertained here there's a steely determination to you from a young age to make it work, to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the opening scene, Danny? What is the opening scene to No Way Out, No Surrender? Is it you leaving home at 15? Is it you going to Central? Because you went to Central School, right? You went
I did, Central School of Speech and Drama.
What is the opening scene to No Way Out, No Surrender?
I think it's quite calm at the beginning of this film.
It's a heist film with a quiet opening.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's that little space underneath Waterloo, underneath the big roundabout where the IMAX is.
Yes, I know. I know, with the blue walls.
Yeah, and the blue walls. And there's something about, a lot of my life has been spent walking underneath that space. I work at the National, but even during the years when I'm, you know, when we were sort of struggling teenagers, sort of waiting, being on a waiting list for a space at a hostel, there were moments spent underneath there. And, you know, I think one night of rough sleeping. So, yeah, there's something about that space because, you know, being there as a 15-year-old and then being there as a, you know, 22-year-old on my way to work at the National, or heading off to the sort of the Young Vic, or taking my kids underneath there,
right,
go and see stuff at the South Bank. It's just there's something about that being underneath that space. It's tinged with pleasure and pain and a journey of growth, you know. So something, it starts underneath there, I think, and it's footsteps. It's just, oh, it's walking, lots of footsteps.
Yes. Because that's a journey, isn't it? That's a journey. That's a journey. And also the echoey, there's a kind of echoey space.
Yeah.
Past, present, future.
That's right. The poems that you sometimes get along the side of the walls.
Yes.
You know, that you can hear the road outside, but it's there's something, it's shelter to some extent as well.
It was rough. I mean, that was rough for a long time, that space.
Yeah.
It was rough. It must have been, I mean, if you're saying you slept there, like you were homeless and slept there, that must have been an intimidating space in the mid-80s, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was quite rough and quite scary. You didn't want to close your eyes for too long. You know, one of the experiences I learned about, you know, sleeping rough, which I only did for one night, I think, while I was waiting for a hostel space. I got kicked out of one hostel and then had to sort of had a day in between or something like that. Spent some time at Centrepoint, which was, you know, which you had to pay to get in. And then to this particular night, you know, it was bloody cold as well, because it was like September or something like that. I think what was interesting about it was that you didn't ever really settle. You could rest for a bit, but then you had to keep moving. And you often see, you know, homeless people walking around, and it's because you can't stop and settle for too long, because, you know, somebody will come and, you know, nick your stuff, or you could be attacked, or, you know, so there's that, and you're outside, you know, there's always that sense of danger. And I think that sense of quite sort of an itinerant life, you know, of a night, you'd have to get up a couple of times and keep warm as well. So, yeah, so that was quite a challenge.
What was it like when you were 22 walking to the National and walking past, like you mentioned there, it's such an amazing transposition of your past and your present, that's a really clumsy way of putting it, but transposing your past and your present, like walking through that space as you're achieving that dream you had, and sort of walking through a space where you struggled, you know? I mean, what was that? Did it occur to you when you were walking through that? Like, were you kind of amazed, or?
I still felt like the same person, to be honest with you. You know, I don't feel that there was a difference really between, certainly my circumstances had changed. You know, I had a studio flat, which was, you know, very supported rent. and I was earning money. I was still skint, and I would often need mum to sort of make me something to eat or live. I was living on sort of you never quite had enough money. Working in theatre, it was quite hard.
May I interrupt and ask a very quick question? What was your mum's comfort food that she would supply to you? That was like
jollof rice with some chicken, or a cantonment stew with yams, which is a spinach and palm oil stew with either fish or meat.
Sounds hearty. Is that hearty?
Yeah, hearty Ghanaian food, basically. Yeah. But most of the time, I learned how to sort of make sort of all bran, turn all bran into a bolognese. Do you know what I mean? Have you ever done that? So basically, the cereal, when you sort of put it in a tomato based stew, it's like meat. But it's all bran. It's great. If you can't afford meat, all brands are fantastic. I hate all bran, as a cereal, but right. Actually in a tomato stew, it makes it, it's like a bolognese. It really is. It's delicious. You should try it.
I've never ever have heard. Was this something you were taught or something you came?
No,
through,
I just
experimented.
I'm quite creative with the food at the time. I think it was out of necessity.
Have you ever made a Rice Krispies Wellington? Have you ever made any other cereal into food?
No other cereals. It was just something about the nature of all bran. I don't know. Maybe it was like I just decided to throw it in a tomato sauce and was like, hey, this works.
When was the last time, Danny? Come on, man. When was the last time you had all brown bolognese?
It's been a long time. times have changed somewhat. And I think probably, it wasn't until I met my wife that things felt like they were really changing, because she works in marketing, and so she understands that I used to say yes to everything. I used to do things simply because I enjoyed them. But then when you have a family, you have to sort of make sort of slightly better decisions about what things you engage in. And that does make a difference to the way in which you view yourself as a professional and how you spend your time. So that was the big shift for me.
I've got to come back to one question about, but I just have to ask, you used to say yes to everything. Was that a mindset because you just never knew where it might take you?
I think that was it. Yeah, exactly. And also, I loved what I did, and any opportunity to do it and work with people who also loved it was that felt like home. That felt actually, that was what fed me and still does to some extent, but I would read a mate's play, and get paid in bus fares, You can't do that when you've got four kids, you've got to sort of go,
you need four bus fares, if not five.
Yeah, exactly. This is 6 hours of my life in a day, or for a week, 6 hours for 7 days. I can't spend that much time doing this. but it was great because I was able to completely indulge in my passion, and as a result I learned an awful lot about how to do this.
What was the play you were in at the National when you were 22? Was that the first time you acted at the National?
It probably would have been one of the first times. So I think I was there for a season, and we did two plays. One was The Machine Wreckers, I think. So it was a double bill. What was the other play? Oh my God.
Treasured memories, Danny. Treasured memories.
Treasured memories. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't remember it being that good. But it was great to work at the National, and every single time I've been in there since, it's like you walk into that space and, all the staff are the same, and it's like being part of a family, a huge family. So what did I do back in there? I'm looking at my CV here. happen to have in front of me, going through all of my highs and lows of my career.
This is clearly a big
high. Actually, the other play was Richard II.
Oh, what, by Deborah. William Shakespeare?
By William Shakespeare.
So it's gone from not being good, the thing that you thought you were into, oh, it's actually Shakespeare.
No, it was really good. It was really good. And it was Fiona Shaw was playing Richard II.
Oh, wow.
And it was directed by Deborah Warner. And the other play we were doing was called The Machine Wreckers, which was a big sort of political play. And that was directed by Katie Mitchell. And in the play with Katie Mitchell, I can't remember the name of the writer, but anyway, The Machine Wreckers, it was about the Luddites.
Right.
And at one point, I think I played an 11-year-old girl. We played many different characters. I played a sailor, but I also played an 11-year-old girl, believe it or not, all what? 6 foot, 5 foot.
I was
going
to say, Danny, you're not a small chap.
You're not a small boy. No, exactly. That was the nature of the ensemble type of work we were doing at the time, and we seemed to pull it off. I don't think we got complaints. I didn't get mentioned in the reviews either negatively or positively, so I think we got away with it.
What was it like being in Richard II with Fiona Shaw?
Incredible experience. You know, the audience were it was a promenade stage. It was my the first time I'd worked on that play. That
Richard,
play
is... Richard II, is my memory, is he Richard II is quite often, is it right that he's quite a floaty, ethereal...
Yeah, thing? Sort of he's... king who ends up being sort of usurped by Bolingbroke.
That's cousin. Right.
Yeah.
Because so Fiona Shaw playing Richard II probably caused a bit of a stir at the time with
it that. It did. It was quite sort of radical, you know, to have a woman play this... titular part at the National. It was quite a thing, but she absolutely made it work, because also, you know, Richard the Second was a young king. I mean, I think he came to the throne when he was like 12 or something like that. He wasn't really prepared for kingship, you know, and also we're still talking about kings that are, you know, divine right, and all of the nature of that. He's like a Tutankhamun whose only, you know, qualifications for the job is that he's the son of.
Well, thank goodness we've moved on past that kind of belief. And
yeah, system. Right. Oh, I haven't. And so also, you know, that it was a very turbulent time. You know, it was the War of the Roses, you know, around that time, and, you know, the war with France. Mm. And so he's got a lot to navigate, and he doesn't quite know how to do that, and eventually is murdered but there's a brilliant speech which has lived with me, and I can't even remember it.
The middle of the night, you'll be lying there in bed, and all of a sudden you'll sit bolt upright.
It'll suddenly come to me. I'm trying to find it, but it's even if I remembered the first word, there was a period of time where I could literally recite the whole play because I heard it so many times. And there's something about Shakespeare's rhythm that, you know, that the heartbeat, you know, the right. Five beats of the, you know, the iambic pentameter, which is what, you know, we still speak the iambic pentameter in language in English, because it is our rhythm. Something about that meant that the poetry of and the iambic pentameter and the beat just meant that I could almost recite the whole play, you know, from listening to it, and it was a really wonderful experience to be involved in a production of, you know, Michael Bryant was in it, and David Threlfall played Bolingbroke.
Wow.
I mean, it was, you know, for a young actor to be working opposite and with my mates, Julian Reintup, who I went to drama school with.
Oh, really?
BK, yeah, and Jonathan Slinger, you know, just all sort of really, really good guys. We're all still mates now. And I think because it's one of our first jobs and we were such fish out of water, we, you know, we just sort of bonded and connected. We had that experience, you know, as a shared experience that has kept us, sustained us for many years after it, you know. In so many ways.
Well, we've got the title of the film. We've got a great opening scene in the in the Waterloo roundabout Undercroft sort of area with the footsteps. But who's going to be cast as Danny Sapani in the lead in No Way Out, No Surrender? Is it going to be Julian Reintut, for example, or is there someone else you had in mind to play the lead?
I didn't have anybody in mind, really.
Are you going to play yourself?
I think it might be me. I think it'll have to be me playing myself. But you know, at different phases in my life, probably using these different phases of my life to overcome evil, you know. So you know that sense where you kind of feel like you know, when I was sort of homeless and I, you know, and I was quite rough, you know, and maybe a, you know, a little bit less rough in my 20s, and then with my kids, you know, even more, this progression, but all of these different characters
yep.
are assumed. So it's somebody, so Danny Sapani has an overview of all of these different stages in his life, but he's using them, these different personas, to overcome some great, you know, monster.
This is, I love the idea of you also talking about yourself in the third person there, which I'm a fan of as well. Like Danny Sapani.
You encourage this, Toby. I'm just doing my thing.
No, it's I'm so invested because you're so invested. I have to ask you, if you're going to play yourself across the different periods of your life, what are your thoughts on de-aging technology used in films and television these days?
I think it's terrible. Have you seen? I mean, I just think don't do it. It's so much better when you cast somebody else as the older you and the younger. Do you know what I mean? I think it's awful, you know. I mean, thankfully, I don't actually, apart from the greys, I don't look that much different to how I did when I was in my 20s. Even when I was 15, you see pictures of me, I've got this really old face that I had to sort of grow into. So I'm quite fortunate in that sense, you know. I probably put on a few pounds here and there. I think that's, you know, gravity is doing its work.
Not the face.
But not too much on the face. I'm still growing into it, actually.
Oh, that's a lovely. That's really nice. What a privilege that is to be able to say that. I mean, I did watch something the other day actually that had de-aging technology in it, and boy, oh boy, did it stick out. Like it was literally, they might as well have been wearing like a chicken costume. You know what I mean? Like, I can't not look at you because I can just see the joins.
Exactly. Don't do it. I mean, I had to do it once. In a scene, but luckily it was only sort of something like, I don't know, 10 or 15 years before, and all they had to do was get rid of the grey and you know, put a slight filter on the camera, you know, to get rid of some of those wrinkles. But anything, you know, longer than that, you know, it's just, you know, what, bouncing around like a teenager, you know, trying to look, you know, 20. I just think that's just nuts. If you're in your 50s, it's like, just get somebody else to play the part, you know. We buy it. It's like The Crown, you know, how brilliant the different stages of the Queen's life are portrayed in that. You know, by a different actor, you just move differently at different stages in your life, and it's just brilliant to see, you know, different people interpret that. You know, I think that's a much, you know, much, much more convincing and also more satisfying to watch.
Would you ever, if there was a role that you're really, really keen on though, and they said it will involve de-aging, would you seriously reconsider your position, or would you stick to your guns?
I would insist that they got somebody else to play the younger me. Do you know what I mean? So I'm sort of like pissing on my own argument. I don't think this is necessarily about, this isn't about the span. I think this is a film that's really about time in the present, but borrowing from different personas from one's past and future. Well, not future, obviously, but yeah, from one's life. So it's a different story. But I would, if there was a biopic and we were to kind of, you know, span the entire life in a linear sense, then I would insist on somebody else playing the younger or, you know, decrepit me.
I just think you the whole way through, because I quite like films or television shows where they have the person, you know, as we know them in the present, playing themselves in the past, because it's just they're that, you know, you just, it's, I like the kind of sense, because you get that extra sense of displacement then by having them being older around, you know what I mean, younger people. Or you know, like sometimes in the Christmas Carol, you know, where Scrooge goes back and he's older, but he's in the schoolroom with the children.
Right. I see what you mean. No, I think you're right. There is something also satisfying about that, but then you're not investing in this person being, because it is it's the essence of the person that you're aiming for, rather than, you know, the verisimilitude of them looking older or younger. You know, it's them looking at their life or being sort of conscious in a different space. I think that's a different thing.
So we've got you in the lead. We've got the name of the film. We've got the opening scene. I was going to ask you what genre would the film be, but we know it's a heist movie.
Yes.
We know the budget's big.
So, yeah, yeah.
But have you ever been in a heist film?
Yeah, I was in a great film directed by Danny Boyle. Trance.
Yes.
Which is a great heist film with James McAvoy and Vincent Cassell and Rosario Dawson, and that was a great experience. Just fantastic story, fantastic kind of experience filming in London. You know, there were some fast cars in that, and a bit of jeopardy. We stole a painting.
I was going to say, is it people were hypnotized or something?
And there was some hypnotism in there as well. It was based on a TV series that was filmed in the 90s with Neil Pearson. Called Trance as well, I can't remember. Anyway, but this was a great experience.
That is a heck of a cast, isn't it? I've just brought it up in front of me here as well. And did you learn much on, like, what did you learn when you were making that film about your trade? I mean,
it was my first real, you know, big sort of movie experience. I think I'd been in maybe the Oxford Murders that came before, you know, John Hurt and Elijah Wood,
yep,
and those other people in it. But, you know, it was a film where I had a part that kind of went all the way through, you know. I felt really emotionally connected to that, you know, to the story and to the character. And working with Danny Boyle was just, you know, a dream, you know.
What's he like as a director? What's he like?
He's a workaholic for a start, you know. I mean, he was just, you know, he'd be there at lunch kind of going, come on, when are we going to start shooting again? You know, he was just, you know, he was constantly on it, but just very insightful, very, very intelligent, but man, but very also of the people. I don't know of a better way to say that, really. I felt like I was being directed by a mate. He was, you know, someone you trust, you know, we spoke the same language. And he just makes such great movies. He's, you know, really intelligent and human stories.
You say of the people, I think, because that came out, obviously, 2013 was, you know, a year, well, not even a year, but after the
Olympic
ceremony. Yeah. And there was that famous picture of him queuing up to buy lunch at one of the concession stands around the Olympic Park,
yeah,
which people were sort of, so kind of proud to see, yeah, or just like, yeah, so yeah, pleased to see that he, you know, is there just queuing up like everyone else, part of the experience.
Yeah, that's Dan. He's just he's a good guy. He's just, you know, he's as I say, of the people. And, you know, he talks about his football team and he, you know, he grew up in sort of up north, and he's just, you know, he's just really smart guy. You know, I think it's a real kind of thing, you know, there's a lot of talk at the moment of kids who went to private schools or who are the sons or daughters of, you know, and this kind of divide in our industry. And it takes people like Danny, who, you know, I don't know whether he went to a comp, but I imagine he did, you know, just, you know, that there is, you can bust through all of this just by, you know, hopefully being hardworking and good, and that it doesn't have to be a barrier where you were born or who you were born to, you know, it is your circumstances. So, you know, that's, people like him are an inspiration for that.
Now, if that was, you said that was your first kind of big film experience in respect to like budget and having a role that went all the way through. Was it everything that you had hoped it would be? Was it what you thought it would be, having worked in theatre and television before? What was your expectation and what was your sort of reality?
You know, up until that point, I hadn't done a lot of camera work, you know. I think I just, maybe I'd done Penny Dreadful by then, and that was a real eye-opener. But, you know,
that was terrific.
The difference between working in TV and working in film is huge, you know. Because of the size of the screen and what you have to do to convey, you know, your story in that kind of particular space. And so it was very much, I was still in kind of the learning curve. I was still trying to work it all out, and I was working with people who, you know, who ate and slept that stuff, you know, for breakfast. You know, it was just their meat and potatoes. And so I did a lot of watching and listening and kind of working it all out. you know, and I'm still being employed. So I think I'm still working out. It's what keeps me kind of going is, you know, that there are, that, you know, you can always get slightly better at what you do. And, you know, just understanding the parameters of your kind of space are really important. When you're on stage, I know what stage left and stage right is. I know, you know, how far I have to speak, or how loud I have to speak, or how much I have to do to be able to contact a live audience. And on camera, I'm still working it out, and it's fun.
What do you think was the last time, or the most recent time, where you say you're still learning, where you thought, oh yeah, that's a okay, yeah, okay.
It's still happening, because it's you know, you obviously had the way I contact a script is the same, you know, it's words, it's characters, it's you know, objectives and super objectives and all of that sort of stuff and intentions. And then you come on set, and then suddenly you have to sort of remind yourself of what the parameters are, and what you have to negotiate, and you try and sort of imagine what you're walking into, you know, what the set's going to be like, what world am I kind of, you know, trying to create here, aside from all of the things that are already there for you, you know. There's so much imaginative work that's actually done for you, but then you still got to do a bit of work in terms of who you are and why you're there and who you're speaking to and what you want from them. And then of course, you know the size of the camera and getting to know the DOP and getting to know your lighting guy and your grips and your crew, and just so that you can kind of, because when everybody works together and has a relationship together, that's when you get success on as many takes as you possibly can, which is the trick, I suppose, you know, to give the director and the editor as much options to work with. You know, if you're scrapping 8 out of 10 takes, then that's, you're not doing your job.
Also, great, very important to get to know the director of photography and lighting, because they make you look good, right? And if you don't,
absolutely,
if you annoy absolutely. Them, piss them off, then.
Oh yeah, especially if you've got dark skin as well. You know, that's another kind of thing to negotiate.
Well, that's a real issue that has only kind of been approached in the last few years, it feels.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Have you noticed a change in how lighting has been altered?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the whole industry, I used to be, you walk onto set, sometimes even to a kind of makeup trailer, and there'd be nobody who dealt with, you know, black hair or black skin. And so you'd have to sort of, you know, somebody would kind of go, you know, nervously, you know, cut your hair, or nervously sort of go, yeah, no, you're all right, and a bit of anti-shine and off you go. Whereas other people are sitting in there getting properly groomed, you know. You know, and that was tough, because you felt like there wasn't really a place for you in this industry. You know, those little things, those little microaggressions can be quite damaging. You know, and similarly, you know, you might be doing a scene with a bunch of you might be the only black person on set, and then suddenly they've brought this, you know, super powerful light, and it's just for you. You know, and you feel like you're, you know, the special case on set. But now I think people are much, you know, the cameras have become more sophisticated, and people have become, you know, because there are a lot of DOPs, black DOPs, certainly in America, who are leading the way in how to shoot black skin. That's what diversity does, right? It opens our eyes to more possibilities, and so, you know, things change as a result of that, and people feel more welcome.
Have you watched, not out of vanity, I might add, like, I'm just wondering, have you ever watched back some of your older work, when that wasn't being looked at or wasn't being thought about, and like compared it to the more modern pieces where that has been a greater consideration?
I haven't done that. I tend to kind of leave things once I'm done with them, but it might be quite interesting, actually, you know. But probably I'd pick up on other things, do you know what I mean? so I think there is, you know, in terms of the industry, it's everything's moving forward. It's not just, you know, lighting or hair and makeup or you know, so many things are becoming technically more advanced than they were. So you'd look back at something, you know, back in the day, and maybe the stories You know, I think some of the writing, you know, back then was quite brave and bold, but it's nothing like what we're making on, you know, the risks that we're taking because of all the streaming platforms now.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of stuff that you'd think, you know, that seems a bit dated now. You know what I mean? And so yeah. So, but I've never done that. But I'm sure that it'd be a bit of an eye opener.
Talking about eye opening, which parts of your life would definitely have to be in No Way Out, No Surrender, and why? Which parts of your life would definitely have to be in there?
Oh God! It's they'd have to be some hostage situations. Not hostage, but I think it's a metaphor for some of the moments that I've had in my life.
I've
felt like I've been a hostage to my own, you know, my own flaws or my own making, and have had to find ways to negotiate my way out of a situation. So there'd definitely be some hostage situations in there.
Is that, sorry to interrupt, is that like you were saying earlier about saying yes to everything when you were younger? Is that partly that, and also
I think probably partly the times where I've put myself in a situation, a bit of self-sabotage in there, you know, that comes with growing up, you know, and sometimes the mistakes you make lead to greater consequences than you'd hope for. And then you've got to work your way out of it. And I think that would be very true of my life.
And what about your sort of career progression? Are there moments that you would have to, are there kind of key points in your career?
Serious highs, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you get out of the hostage situation, you know, and you're running down the street and you find the pot of gold at the end of the street, and you know, it's a lot like a game. It's probably like, you know, I don't know, Grand Theft Auto or something. I've never played it, but I hear it's a lot of fun, you know, driving around.
Yeah, never played it, says Dan. Yeah.
I've never played it. I've never been any good at any kind of first-person games. I stopped at FIFA 96. That was the last. Yeah, that was me, you know. But yeah, I've watched other people play it. I've watched my kids play it. And, you know, it just looks like it's a romp, you know, just driving around, you know, taking stuff, grabbing stuff, running away, you know. So yeah, so there's probably moments of, you know, finding the pot of gold or the bag of diamonds underneath the and wondering what to do with it.
Okay. And that gets into the heist thing, because diamonds,
exactly.
Nice
diamonds, you know, the expensive painting or the ancient artifact.
Oh, to be, I love an ancient artifact.
Yeah, an ancient artifact that needs to be returned to its rightful home.
Well, like that could almost be like a new sort of version of Indiana Jones actually taking it back to the place where it should be.
Isn't where it should be. Yeah.
Breaking into the museum to exactly. Take it back to the jungle or wherever else.
Yeah. Let's return those Benin bronzes. Let's take back the Elgin marbles. Let's right the wrongs of the Victorian age and the and the looting of, you know, colonial spoils of war. Let's right that wrong.
That is actually a kind of brilliant idea, isn't it, for a film, doing a heist where you're robbing the museum and then taking it back to ancient temples or ancient places, you know, excavations.
And restoring the dignity and the history of people that have had it stripped away from them, and then seeing them relearn about themselves and having people come and visit and restore the respect and dignity to these places.
Imagine if you had in the film a moment, a sequence where you stole from the museum that golden head that Indiana Jones takes at the start of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and then you go back to the jungle and you're rolling the boulder back up that ramp just to get past there.
Yeah. And at any point you could be, you know, you've got to, you're floating above with all the kind of the red lines.
Yes.
And lots of running.
Lots of running.
Yeah, they're just running like Tom Cruise does. I always wanted. I just think he runs so well, doesn't he? And he always has a running bit, doesn't
he? Every film.
I've got to have a running bit. I could look good running.
Have you done much running in film or television? Are you a
good
screen runner?
I haven't. No, I need to do some screen. Oh, no, I did when I worked in India on a film called Singham 2, which was an incredible fantasy. That got two intervals. I mean, it's like 6 hours long.
Wow.
Incredible film made in the Tamil Nadu, and we filmed in Malaysia and in Durban in South Africa. And I did a lot of running in that. It was great.
Was that, do you like that kind of stuff? Do you like that kind of physical?
Yeah, I do. And I got to drive cars and do 3-point turns and do my own stunts and all of that. It was fantastic. Ultimate Force, you know, I got to run around with a rifle and all of that sort of stuff. But Serious and Organized, I did a lot of running around in that. What were they? Serious and Organized cops, you know, dealing with drugs and very dangerous people. I like doing that kind of thing. I don't, you know, it's just on stage you're going to do a play about something, you know, meaningful and deep, and then, you know, you get a bit of fun, get a bit of light-hearted, you know, flashbang entertainment on screen. It's great fun.
How hard is it acting while running or hanging by wires? Like, is it?
There's no acting required because it's literally just you're in the situation. You know, it's outside of yourself. You know, it's just, that's what's so great about it. You know,
do you not pull a face? Do you not have like a character face while you run? Oh, this is the kind of face my character would have while I was running. Or is it just literally your own face just doing? Because Tom Cruise, to be fair, I think he always looks the same when he's running, right? He's always got that same running face.
Running is okay. It's acceptable to have the same face for running. I think you need to, over-dramatize that. It's the very act is a very quite sort of a physical, you know, thing. It sort of takes you, it's an out-of-body experience, isn't it, when you're running really fast.
I love the idea. That's just like the idea. I just want to do more running in films. I just want to do more running.
Do you run in life? Are you a runner?
I am a runner. Yeah, I'm a runner.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe do you do the park run? Are you a park runner?
I'm not a park runner. No. Do you do the park run?
I do the one in Finsbury Park sometimes, and that's a killer.
Yeah. What is a good time for
what's
you?
What's my time?
Yeah, go on.
Recently, I think I started out, I was 33 minutes for 5K, and now I'm on 30. I got the last one I did was 31 minutes. So I'm working my way down.
Is this a late conversion to running, or have you always?
Always ran, but I didn't like running in groups. So I'm a late converter to running in groups. It's a great community to be part of, I think, you know.
Do you have earphones in when you're running? Do you listen to anything?
Sometimes. I mean, I like the Nike Running Club. That's really, really good. You get guided runs with really good coaches. I think that's how I got back into it, to be honest with you, because, you know, running before, I'd just sort of burn myself out, be injured, and then not be able to run for 6 months, you know.
Yeah,
but now I've found a way through you know, guidance and stretching all the time. You know, I spend more time stretching now than I do doing exercise, and it's the only way to sort of sustain any kind of longevity within the sport.
So true. And also, I guess for acting must be useful as well, right?
Really
Pilates useful. Breathing and all that
all of that, you know. And this is what we did when we were younger. We took it for granted, you know, when you were training as a teenager or as in my 20s. And then you sort of, you know, you manage to kind of, you know, go on stage by clearing your throat and doing nothing else. And then you kind of realize, actually, you know, you kind of need all of that, you know, work to prepare you to be able to do your job well. And so I'm back into it big time.
Well, we could have a park run in No Way Out, No Surrender. There could maybe be a running sequence, you're running away from the scene of the crime or the metaphorical hostage situation.
And then get lost amongst the crowd of other runners, you know, and the volunteers on the side going, well done. And then, you know, not knowing what's going on. And suddenly these men in hazmat suits or whatever and rifles suddenly kind of break it all up. But you know, and then because you know the route, man, you just slip off, you're down the hill, you get away.
You've done your stretching, so you cannot be touched.
You can't be touched.
Other people are pulling up with a calf muscle. They've blown their calf muscle.
No. All the baddies are falling over, and, and you know, broken legs and hamstrings. Pull the hamstrings. Pull the muscle. Yeah, but you just keep going. You keep going. Gone. Clear.
So, what moments of your life would you want on the cutting room floor, Danny? What moments from your life would you not want to be in No Way Out, No Surrender? What would you edit out?
I'm not sure I can share those. Maybe they're so terrible. But maybe there's one. You want to like this character? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
You don't want to put things in there that were so kind of, you know, reprehensible, like the time. You know, the kid I bullied at school. You know, there's you don't want that on there. You know,
it's your biopic, so you get to choose the version of yourself moments you want to present.
You want levels of, you know, you want flaws. You don't want complete sainthood, but there are certain things that you probably miss off there, or stuff that wasn't that interesting, something that was a bit boring. You know. You know, because it's a heist movie. It's not a kitchen sink drama.
The most exciting part of a heist film is never when the person is sitting there drawing up a PDF of the route or the plan. You don't sit there. They never linger on them just making a PDF of, got this and we've got the checklist of everything. So, we'll cut that out.
But I suppose the question really is about something that was necessary, was painful or something like that, perhaps.
Yeah,
but even that, I think, you know, losing a parent or whatever, you want that stuff in there. You know, I think that's all part of the what makes a life, isn't it? So, you know. No regrets.
And so what would you say the influences are on this film, from TV, film or literature or comics? Are there any kind of other films or TV shows or any other works of art which you think would have an influence on No Way Out, No Surrender?
I think definitely Wakanda and the Black Panther films, you know, in terms of their... You know, it's a superhero film, but it's with a difference, you know, and it's kind of links to, you know, the what if, you know, the Africa without interference is a theme that's very close to my heart, and restoring dignity in people in their history. I think also perhaps, you know, I just love a good sort of, I love a Mission Impossible. I love a Bourne Identity or a Bond film, you know, these films, and, you know, Trance is a very good example of that. Even like, you know, The Usual Suspects, do you know what I mean? Just something that's an intelligent thriller that, you know, I didn't see that coming. You know, it's just I love a good twist. I love a good twist in a movie, but I love to be sort of entertained. I want to be on the edge of my seat.
What is your favorite ever twist ending? You mentioned The Usual Suspects there. Is that your favorite ever twist ending?
I think it might be one of them, definitely. What did I see the other day? The Pale Blue Eye.
Oh, yes. The new Netflix film with Christian Bale.
Great twist at the end. I didn't see that coming. Do you know what I mean? Oh. You know, that and, you know, and then The Usual Suspects. You know, I just think brilliant. But the twist has to be sort of, it has to be well earned, and it has to sort of then, you know, unravel everything else.
Yes.
You know, everything
yes.
just suddenly makes sense. And you're like, and you can actually go back and watch it and go,
yes,
that's the point. I now that I know... It all fits. It's not fake. You know, they haven't just kind of stuck this bit at the end.
I thoroughly agree, and I think I think that's the genius. I mean, I Usual Suspects is such a great example. It's such a brilliant film, and I think that's it. When you watch it for the second, third, fourth, and multiple times, you see how everything is linked. And you don't, but you watch it that first time, and it is just a brilliant heist thriller.
Yeah.
It's such a remarkable piece of filmmaking and writing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, I think it's probably, you know, it's linked to the whodunits, and, you know, that's you know, watching Glass Onion recently, and I loved, you know, it wasn't what you expected. You know, you kind of speculate all the way through. I reckon, oh, he looks like a bit of a dodgy geezer. You know, that person's got a bit of an agenda, and then you kind of realize. realize actually no, it's much cleverer than that. It's less expected, and of course all of those suspicions that you had have validity, do feed into the story in some way.
Yep.
But it's still not what you expected, and you learn something from that. And I think that's a great journey to go on in a movie.
I completely agree. I don't know if you've seen some of the great little observations people have had of some of the little background details in Glass Onion about how paintings are hung the wrong way up. Have you seen that?
And the knives and all that. The knives are all that. What were they? Knives or guns? Weren't, you know, they're not being loaded, and all of these little details that you go, that was mentioned earlier. And I love all of that, you know, because that's for everybody who's involved in that film. They're having a little game, playing a puzzle. Yep. But for our pleasure and delight, you know, which has a life beyond the film in a way, you know.
Completely. You mentioned Wakanda and Black Panther there. I just wonder what sort of impact has working on those films and the effect that those films have had, the wider sort of societal impact. What effect has that had on you as Danny, but also as an actor?
Yeah, I think, you know, just the ability to believe that it's possible. You know, because, you know, once upon a time, you know, we were in the phase where, you know, they just didn't think making a film like Black Panther, you know, would was possible, that there wouldn't be an audience for it. And boy, were they proved wrong, you know, and it was, you know, for me personally, you know, I keep going back to that 11-year-old boy who went to see Flash Gordon in the Temple of Doom with my uncle back in, you know, 1981, and just look watching the screen and just thinking, I want to be in something like this, but I just can't. I can't even see it. I can't envisage it. You know, I don't have an agent. I've never been to an acting school. I haven't lived in America. I don't know how people, it was just a pipe dream, you know, but to actually be standing at the premiere of Wakanda Forever and in Leicester Square, where I watched Flash Gordon, which was my first cinematic experience.
Really?
Yeah. And just kind of standing there and just being like, you know, this is London. This is where I've grown up. This is where I've placed all of my dreams and hopes in many ways. And here I am, you know, in a film of this nature that means so much to me. And it was just, you know, that it's possible, that anything is possible.
You sort of joked about there, like the finding the diamonds and whatnot and the career highs. Was that when you got that gig? Did you kind of, was that a real punch the air kind of moment?
100%. Yeah. And, you know, and then of course it, like you say, was it more than you expected? Yeah. It was 10 times more than I expected. You know, all the waiting around, all the kind of not really knowing when you were supposed to be, when you're going to film, all of the kind of issues that you might have on a normal set, are just, for me, were blown away, you know, when I just, being part of the scale of that, you know, you've got 150 extras and, you know, brilliantly designed in all of these costumes that reflect all the four corners of African culture and society. And you're telling this sort of, you know, this superhero story. I love a good superhero story. I loved Spider-Man. I used to think I was Spider-Man when I was a kid, you know, and Superman. And, you know, just, you know, all of the you bringing all these different elements that are all rooted in what it means to be kind of human. They're all in our folk tales. You know, all of these elements are in there and are really important to our well-being in many ways. And then, you know, and working with, you know, Angela Bassett and Forest Whitaker and, you know, Chad, God rest his soul, you know, what a fantastic actor, and all the Brits that are on there, Daniel Kaluuya, Letitia Wright, Danai Gurnera, you know, and Michaela Cole as well, who was in the last one. And Ryan Coogler is just, you know, again, another director who's just of the people. And I never imagined that it would be like that. I thought that it would be corporate and scary. And it's like going to the National, actually. It's like walking up the road underneath the arch, and you sort of go into the rehearsal room and, you know, drink a coffee and sit down and you have a chat. But only the scale and the largesse of it is a lot different. But in terms of the work, it's the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what's surprising and very heartwarming.
You mentioned those incredible names there that you worked, you know, you work with on that film. The cast itself is obviously enormous and so impressive. But given the success of the first film, for it to then come back again for a sequel, was it kind of a celebratory atmosphere on set? Did it feel like...
Yeah.
Something so big is happening. Something enormous is happening.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like that the first time, you know, and the second time it was like, you know, we were all excited to revisit that space, because the first time, like I said, nobody thought it was possible, you know, and we were aware that we were doing something that was, you know, groundbreaking in a sense. And so second time round, it was like, how do you follow that? And especially without Chad.
Yeah.
How do we honor the work that he did? How do we tell that story again? How do we create that environment again without your lead? You know, and that was, and I just think that what they did, you know, if you haven't seen it, go and see it. It really is the most fantastic tribute to a fantastic life and to the titular character of the film. It's sometimes, you know, what we do and the way we tell stories crosses over, you know, all our different levels of reality. And this was a film that really satisfies on all of those levels and speaks to the experience and the family atmosphere that we had when we were making it. Chad was always present in that space in the second film as he was in the first.
The film's almost in the can, Danny. No Way Out, No Surrender is almost in the can.
Yeah.
If the critics love it or hate it, how would that affect you and your next project? Do the critics ever affect you?
They used to. They used to when I was working in theatre. Not so much now. Do you know what I mean? I think there's no better critique than word of mouth. And I think this film will speak to people of my generation, you know, people who know me and who have lived similar lives to me or even not. Do you know what I mean? I just think it's there's no way out and there's no surrender. It's gonna be a box office smash, baby.
Oh, doubtless.
Doubtless, right? Doubtless.
You starred alongside Adrian Lester in Him, which was streamed from the Almeida. It was during lockdown, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2021. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As an experience, how was that? And also, as an experience, how was it to read reviews of a stage play for which people couldn't be in the same room as you?
Aside from the fact that we spent all of rehearsals basically obeying the 2 meters apart, you know, we had designed props and the set was designed so that we were always 2 meters apart and so that people weren't watching it going, well, they're not following protocol. You know? You know, we didn't want to be like the politicians on this. We wanted to kind of do the right thing. And it was... you know, not all politicians, obviously, but we know we don't have
we know names. We know names.
There was no bum touching. So aside from that, you know, and we thought we were going to be shut down. We thought that this was going to. We thought we were going to do it live, and then we got shut down, and then it wasn't going to happen. And then we were given this opportunity, you know, and it really taught us something about the nature of the work. You know that we could deliver it in this different way. And it was, I think for a lot of people, it was the first bit of live theatre that they were able to see. And we hadn't worked, you know, I mean, I think I'd managed to go to Hungary to finish the end of season one of Halo, but just to be in a space and to actually work on something felt like a real privilege, you know, because again, you know, 2020, we didn't know how long this was going to go on for. We didn't know anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what it did to the industry was devastating. You know, to have theatres empty and silent felt like felt like the end of civilization in some sort of, you know, horrible way. And so to be able to be in a space, there was only two of us, and to obey all the protocols. And we had Lolita there as well, who wrote the play, and Blanche McIntyre. And anytime anybody came into the rehearsal space, it was with masks. But then to deliver this work, you know, streamed, and they brilliantly captured the live experience and how, you know, it was just a joy. And the feedback, you know, obviously you went on social media and people were just hungry for this kind of experience. It just lit a flame, and it was kind of a reminder of why we do this in the first place. You know, it's so important that we have this outlet, this, you know, for our well-being, for our mental health, for our well-being, to share stories and to share joy and to share pain, to talk about all the things that him talks about in a really honest way. You know, the relationship with these two men, and it starts with the funeral and ends with the funeral, and that was very much a lot of people's experience, and it was an opportunity to feel connected and understood in that space. So it's one of the highs, definitely, of my career.
Well, No Way Out, No Surrender is in the can.
Yeah.
It's the premiere. Where's the premiere taking place?
Premiere's taking place in London, Leicester Square. You know, the place where I am constantly, you know, I've walked through that space in every stage of my life. It's where it all happens, doesn't it? Prems, that's where they happen.
And it has to be big, has to be enormous.
Big, has to be enormous.
Make a statement. Everybody. Who's invited? Who's definitely invited?
Well, obviously my family, all of my my community, my mates, all of my family, my acting family, my personal family, and anybody who wants to come. Anybody who wants to come. You know, that's what's great about sometimes going to see you know, all the Black Panther films, and I've been to see some films, some of the, you know, the first film, second film, we hired a cinema and we got all of our mates down and we all together, and they all cheered every single time they saw me on the screen. You know, it was like it took all of the kind of, you know, the pretentiousness out of it. You know, this was an event, and it was like going to, I don't know, watch a gig, watch you know, your favorite band in the park, you know, like we used to do when the weather was better. So so it's that kind of vibe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Who isn't invited? Who is absolutely not invited to the premiere? And why is that?
I don't think anybody's not invited. You can all come. Bless. You can all come. Everybody can come. You know, even the corrupt politicians, you know, they can come, and so that we can then kind of, you know, grill them at the Q&A. No Way Out, No Surrender. Yeah.
There we have it. No Way Out, No Surrender, starring Danny Sapani, featuring Miss Hyams, Parkrun, Black Panther, All Brand Bolognese, Richard II, Danny Boyle, being paid in bus fares and returning ancient artifacts to their rightful home. Danny Sapani, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This has been an absolute joy.